session of the Springfield Planning Commission to order. All rise for the pledge of allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have any adjustments to the agenda? Is there any business from the audience that does not pertain to tonight's public hearing? Tonight we're holding a quasi-judicial public hearing. And we're involved a single applicant requesting four separate approvals on the same E Street property. We have a discretionary use approval for a residential care facility for more than 15 persons. File TYP 315-00004. And we have a discretionary use approval for a child care facility for more than 13 children, also under the same file number. We also will have a site plan approval for the physical development of these two uses on the subject property. File TYP 215-00028. And also, we have a tree felling permit to allow the removal of more than 5 trees in a single calendar year. File number TYP 215-0027. We are combining the hearings for these matters into a single event, thereby allowing anyone in attendance tonight the opportunity to provide testimony on any or all of these proposals with a single trip to the podium. This avoids the unnecessary procedural action of opening a single hearing, asking for testimony on just one item, closing the hearing for that item, and then going on to the next hearing, following the same order of testimony, and then on to the next, and so forth. The rules for testimony are the same for each proposal, so please remember to raise any issues you may have with enough specificity to enable the applicant and the Planning Commission the opportunity to understand your issue and therefore be able to provide a response. Before you leave the podium, if you wish, the record to remain open to allow additional time to submit testimony on any or all of these proposals, please inform the Planning Commission Chair that you are requesting that the written record on one or more of these proposals remain open for at least 1 week. By law, the Planning Commission must grant such a request. However, a record extension longer than 1 week is at the discretion of the Planning Commission. We will now have a legal introduction. Mary Bridget Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to go over the hearing procedures for this evening. This evening, our hearing is characterized as a quasi-judicial land use hearing. It's a de novo hearing, meaning that any issue can be raised that's relevant to the approval criteria. Quasi-judicial means you have certain due process procedural rights. Those rights include the right to notice, to present evidence, to have a written decision based upon standards, and to an impartial decision maker. The purpose of the hearing is to establish a record upon which a decision can be made. Evidentiary rules are more relaxed than they would be in a court. It is important to note, though, you must raise procedural and substantive issues at this hearing, or you'll be prohibited from raising those issues on appeal before the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals. A person raising the issue must support raising the issue with statements or evidence that's specific enough so the decision makers have an opportunity to respond. If you are the applicant, you must raise concerns regarding any proposed conditions of approval to preserve your right to appeal those or to seek damages. In failure to raise a constitutional or other issues relating to conditions of approval to allow the Planning Commissioner to respond to issues, preclude an action for damage in circuit court. The burden of proof tonight is more likely than not or preponderance of the evidence. The applicable criteria is that the decision is subject to is actually posted on the walls behind the Planning Commissioners. There are three different separate types of criteria depending on the decision that you're making tonight. The record consists of the application, supporting information, the staff report, supporting documents, and then any testimony or documents that are taken during the hearing. If you'd like an item entered into the record, please present it to the planning secretary orally or in writing. If there's any question in your mind whether material is in the record, make a point of asking that it be accepted into the record. As the chair mentioned, you have the right to have the record held open for 7 days. Any longer extension is at the discretion of the planning commission. If new evidence is introduced, the record may be held open for additional time so there can be a response. A continuance of the hearing is discretionary with the planning commission. That's separate from the record. Testimony is done by stepping up to the podium, giving your name and address for the record. The planning commission will issue a written decision after the record is closed. For this type of hearing, the decision of the planning commission can be appealed to the city council. Oregon land use law requires that the planning commission disclose any ex parte contacts, conflicts of interest related to this matter, and allow any person to challenge a planning commissioner for bias. A conflict of interest occurs in a situation where the decision maker, his family, or business would benefit or suffer because of their decision. And an ex parte contact is a communication to the decision maker that includes a substantive issue regarding the application and that occurs outside of the public venue. Chair, at this time, it's appropriate to open the hearing.
I will open the public hearing now. Is there any member of the Planning Commission who has any declarations of potential conflict of interest or disclosure of ex parte contact?
None.
I will state that at a period of time about 10 to 12 years ago, while employed for the Registered Guard, I made a number of visits to this facility. That's been quite some time ago, and I have not had any contact since then. I want to state that I do not have any bias either for or against this proposal based on those contacts.
Thank you, Chair.
We will now have the staff report. Mark McCaffrey.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, I'm going to start off with providing a brief description of the project and in context with the three different land use applications before us. And before I get started, I just wanted to let the commission know that if you have any questions during my brief report here, feel free to interrupt. I'll try to leave a little time for questions after we address each report. So the project proposal is to renovate and expand the existing Sweetbriar Villa assisted living and memory care facility with the addition of a two-story, 49,500 square foot wing to the existing 17,000 square foot single-story structure. The existing facility will be converted to serve memory care patients. The new wing will serve patients requiring assistance with daily living and will also add a new 750 square foot licensed children's daycare facility. Let's talk a little bit about the location. All right. This is a 2.9 acre site off of East Street where 61st and 63rd Streets meet. All the streets in those areas are considered or functionally classified local streets. What you see to the south is home of the Thurston Colts, that's Thurston High School area. And to the east we have Thurston Park and then a couple of pretty dense, low density residential subdivisions to the north. This is showing that we have low density residential areas surrounding pretty much the northwest and east of the property with public lands and open space to the south. Not to mention that this property is also designated by the comprehensive plan as low density residential, and there are no other refinement plans on the property. Briefly talking about procedure, we have three applications before us, and it has to do with the development of one project. It was the director's decision to elevate both the site plan review and the tree felling permit to the level of a type 3. and along with the discretionary use before you today. And that had to do with the fact that residential care facilities in the low-density residential area require two things. They require discretionary use and a site plan approval. Also, the actual size of the development proposal in this case, it exceeds 25,000 square feet, and it would have needed site plan approval anyways. And so the tree felling permit, because of its beholden to the development in these other two subsequent applications, was elevated before the commission for your approval. Child care facilities on local streets in low-density residential areas also required discretionary use approval. And just a quick note, what triggers the tree removal permit is more than five trees over 5 inches in DBH on a property that's larger than 10,000 square feet, which this definitely fits the bill. We received three comments in one phone call, and one of those phone calls was to request us to do a site visit to talk a little bit about the project. The three comments, out of the three of them, one addressed each of the three land use applications. One was specifically about the tree felling permit, and then one was a site visit, which again talked about concerns with the tree felling permit. And so altogether, we had a few concerns from neighboring property owners. One was traffic impacts to the neighborhood, especially concerns with the intensification of the property affecting E Street, which is a local road, and also with the school being nearby. Viewshed displacement, I may have termed that incorrectly. There was some concern from one neighbor that the removal of a stand of mature trees, which you'll see in a second, that are located in the northeastern part of the property, would drastically sort of change the aesthetics of the neighboring area, especially looking south. There were also questions about tree removal that were answered on site and by email. And there are also questions about a number of additional units that were proposed as part of the two-story expansion. Here's the site plan, and I tried to kind of focus on what is considered the new areas of addition. If you look to the western part of the property, you can see what already exists there. There's the 17,000 square foot, one-story facility dedicated primarily to 25 units of residential care facility and 5 memory care facility units. Put some attachments to it here. We can see that the original building is going to be revamped to have primarily all the memory care. In fact, the applicant is asking to sort of drop some of the units that exist there and install 22 memory care units. There's also going to be a new drop-off area if you look to the sort of the middle of the site, but there are no new accesses proposed to access onto E Street. Then we see on the eastern side the two-story residential care facility, which is going to be 41 units dedicated to that use, and then the addition of a small 750 square foot child care facility to the east. Some of the things that aren't as noticeable that are on this site plan is the required parking and circulation as a result of developing this property all the way around. And then also we see an existing trash enclosure in the middle of the property, and we see the relocation of an outdoor play facility that will be for the child care use. The applicant also submitted a tree removal plan, and this is just showing the eastern portion of the site that is at this point not developed. The proposal is to remove 53 trees. You'll notice that a few of those trees are beyond their property line and actually in the right-of-way in city jurisdiction. Other than that, you can also notice that the impervious areas, including driveway and parking lot features, not to mention the building, will require most of these trees to be removed in order to successfully develop the area. applicant also submitted a landscaping plan, which at this point shows that 41 trees are proposed to be replaced. Now, they're not all on the East Street right-of-way, as can be seen here. Those are the continuation of red sunset maples that have already established pretty well in the western part of the property. But there are parking lot improvements that have some ash trees and also meeting some stormwater quality requirements in the corners there. So let's jump into the discretionary use criteria, unless there's any questions. So I just want to make a mention that this is paraphrased. We actually have the discretionary use criteria right up there. Those are all the details. But ultimately, what we're trying to answer when we look at this new development is, does the proposed uses comply with the Metro Plan and the Springfield Development Code? And staff believes it does. Like I said, low-density residential allows both the child care facility and the residential care facility under a discretionary use approval. And then we get to, is the site suitable for the proposed uses? And this actually has a few items to it that are worthy of exploring. One is the concern about traffic increase. With a new facility that has more units in it, there's the possibility that the traffic could increase in this area, but may be able to be mitigated with right-of-way improvements that will be required for this proposal in the form of a public improvement plan. One way that could pan out is East Street starts getting a little narrow as we head towards 63 Street across the property frontage. That most likely may be able to be widened to its full right-of-way width and you know, be able to have a little more visibility as cars travel east on East Street and head up 63rd Street. There were really no noise, vibration, or aesthetic considerations that should result from this development, especially after construction is done. And fire accessible circulation using a driveway that circumferences the entire property appears to be meeting fire safety standards. There will be a question about access to the property from East Street in order to effectively support the new addition with fire and safety services that we can get to with the site plan review. And lastly, the Public Works Department has determined that adequate public facilities are available for this site, and any additional requests are presented as findings and conditions within the site plan review. The last one down there is, can adverse effects be mitigated through the site plan review, specific development standards of the Springfield Development Code, and other conditions as needed? And to really talk about that, is to kind of segue into the provisions that specifically pertain to group care facilities, which residential care facilities are under. There are several criterion that these facilities need to make or meet in order to mitigate adverse impacts to surrounding neighborhoods. In this case, there are actually larger landscape setbacks than would otherwise be required in a low-density residential area, 15 feet from the front and 20 feet from the side and back for buildings. And for landscaping, the landscape setbacks can be reduced as little as 5 feet, provided that there's landscaped screening and there's also that use is being used for parking lots or driveways, for that matter. One important one that helps buffer a site from adjacent uses is retaining landscaping on the property. And the requirement through this specific development standard is to retain 25% of the lot to be landscaped. And that was something that the applicant had submitted on their site plan and through a calculation was able to prove that they were able to retain that amount. Any parking area, especially if it's going to be in the front of the building, needs to be screened. If you think about the landscape plan I showed you, we do have three spaces or six spaces that are on the front of the building, and they are they're outside of the required landscape setback, and they also should be pretty well screened with the street trees and other stormwater treatment plants that will be installed along that street frontage. An important one, especially when we think about intensifying a use is looking at maximum density, which there is a provision in the group care facilities specific development standards that speaks to this. And it's simply 24 bedrooms per net acre. And as I mentioned, this site is about 2.98 acres. It does not have any streets going through it or any sorts of right-of-way or public property that would drop the net acreage down below the 2.98. So when we factor that together, we get about 72 bedrooms available for this site. As we have learned from our applicant, the total amount that they're proposing with this improved expansion is 63, which meets the maximum density requirement, or does not exceed it in this case. Child care facilities has a sort of a similar set of specific development standards. One, they have to meet state regulations, and more specifically, they have to be licensed and meet the regulations under child services and development under the state. Outdoor play enclosures are required to be fenced, and the fencing actually needs to be somewhat screened to try to avoid noise and any other concerns to adjacent properties. One of the advantages, and we might take a look at the site plan in a moment here, is that the location of the outdoor play area facility is in the rear of the building adjacent to another outdoor play facility owned by the Thurston High School. One thing of note that was made a condition of approval is to raise the 4-foot fence that they proposed to a 6-foot fence, which is identified as a specific provision as part of these standards. Public sidewalks and drop-off areas are required on the facility, and also a landscape setback commensurate to the setback we just spoke about with the group care facilities is required. Any questions so far about the specific development standards?
I have a question in relation to the drinking water protection overlay districts. It sounds to me as if the time of travel zone is within that that might impact the Thurston Middle School drinking water wellhead that is a sub wellhead. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And that's been addressed, I'm assuming, throughout this process.
Yeah, it's been being addressed in two ways, Commissioner. Along with this, the three submittals, which came in on the same day, I believe, on September 28th, it was made known to the applicant that they should apply for what's called the Drinking Water Protection Exemption Permit. Which goes over to sub and some information on certain materials that they might be having on site are sort of reviewed by Amy Chenitz, who is our drinking water protection coordinator. And upon that review, it was determined that a drinking water protection overlay application would be required. And so as a condition of approval, I believe under the site plan review, we have inserted a condition that requires prior to site plan final delivery, we would require that application to be reviewed and approved. So it's my understanding that the applicant is working on that as, you know, as we speak. But yeah, we'll hold them to that condition, you know, prior to accepting the final site plan. And you were right about the time of travel. It's between 5 and 10 and 10 and 20 from the Thurston Middle School wellhead. Any other questions? Okay, moving on to site plan review criteria. Again, paraphrase for a PowerPoint, but you can see it. I believe it's right behind Commissioner Dunn. So the first thing with site plan review is looking at consistency with the zoning and district metro plan, which I believe we've already identified the proposed uses are compliant with. The next is looking at the capacity for public and private facilities. This is often something that we get findings from Public Works and Engineering as far as if, you know, utilities are available in the area and if they're available to be stubbed in the way to meet the capacity of the new building. And that note, staff did not find any additional information or any additional conditions that wouldn't otherwise be required for any sort of development project of this nature. The parking and property access question, I started to touch upon. There is no new access being proposed on this site, and maybe I can kick back to the next one here. There. Okay. Interesting. We'll go back to it. Anyways, the two access points that exist right now will be the two primary access points, regardless of the new addition on the eastward side. The access continues around the building at a distance and a width that is able for fire trucks to easily navigate the facility and get around the facility. And as far as parking is concerned, because they expanded the facility and also, more importantly, the number of units that they were going to establish on the property, that kicked up the amount of off-street parking that was required to be provided on the property. The amount that they ended up with in the sort of equation is 1.25 per bedroom plus the number of employees on the highest shift meant that they needed to have 41 spaces for the residential care facility use. The group care facility use is slightly different. It has to do with square footage and also the requirement for one drop-off space. So for the 750 square foot child care facility, three spaces were required with a drop-off space. All of these spaces were able to be almost met on site. The other element of this is there are nine spaces along the East Street frontage, which can be used as a half space credit towards off-street parking. And so with that credit, the whole entire space with the two uses on it got the space up to about 49 spaces. The requirement was 44. And so as site plan reads, they're actually in excess of five spaces on the property. Site plan also talks about significant physical and natural features. I had mentioned that there's a grove of mature Doug firs and big leaf maples on the eastern side of the property, the northeastern side of the property, that seem pretty much contained within the boundaries of the private property. All those trees would be removed as a result of the tree felling permit, virtually because of the fact that they would be in the line of development. And also, they would also be in line of any future right-of-way improvements as well. So a couple notes about the site plan review. The conditions to be met are essentially geared towards them being satisfied when we receive the final site plan submittal. So this is sort of the first step in the site plan review step, or maybe the second. It goes pre-sub, site plan, final site plan, and then we issue a development agreement and they go off and get to work. So I just wanted to make a note of that. A couple things that we have required for, I guess, amendments to what was proposed is an amendment to their lighting and photometric plan. They had identified, I believe, a number, maybe a dozen, of 17-foot freestanding lights to be placed periodically around the property for, you know, safety and illumination of the driveway. In a residential area and within 50 feet from a residential area, that the lighting height actually drops down to 12 feet. And so the proposed requirement is to amend the plan to show lighting no higher than 12 feet on the property. As mentioned earlier, emergency access required to support the new addition may modify the street frontage, or at least the landscaping of the proposed site plan. And at this point, there's going to be a little coordination between the fire marshal, the applicant, also with transportation engineering to make sure that whatever spot is chosen in order to get water onto the property, especially the two-story building, is being done in a way that meets fire code standards and also doesn't impact the circulation of the property as it's been presented to us. We mentioned the drinking water protection overlay application, so I will pass that. And I alluded to, again, the public improvement project plan. Anytime there is a land division or a significant development on a property that abuts a right-of-way that has not been improved completely, a public improvement project plan will be required. And that, again, is also tied into working towards submitting the final site plan. Any questions about the site plan? We're moving on to tree felling. Great. So the tree felling permit criteria, it's about 8 different criteria that we need to look at to make sure that any felling activities are in compliance with our code. So the first question is, are these trees hazardous? It was deemed by the applicant that they probably are not on their own. And are they consistent with state and local standards in nearby environs? By virtue of carrying out the tree felling permit criteria investigation that was prompted because of the number of trees being selected for removal, staff finds that we are meeting those provisions. Another note that I'd like to make about this is there is that phrase nearby environs. I don't know if that's specifically from the tree felling permit, but it alludes to not removing something on a property that could impact properties nearby, creating a windthrow situation or something on a neighboring property. So things like that are taken into consideration when we look at these requests. Also, is the removal necessary for construction? And as we've seen on the site plan, probably about 90% of the trees fall within the proposed development of the property. And is replanting adequate? We have nothing in our code that says the tree replacement needs to be one for one, but will it be adequate to serve the new facility? And staff believes the replanting plan of replacing 41 trees, mostly street trees along the property line, and with trees and stormwater planters spaced throughout the parking area as being adequate to meeting that requirement. Fire mitigation has to do with what happens when the trees fall down. Do we just leave them on the ground and forget about them? The applicant submitted a plan to cork and cut down the trees as needed in smaller sizes so that they could be put into 30 cubic yard, I guess you'd call it trailers, so that they could be hauled off on site in a way that the wood wouldn't be laying on the ground and become a slash hazard. The last question has to do with a haul route, and will the haul route disturb nearby residents? I'm going to kick back to one of our site plans that might help us take a look at this from a visual perspective. This sort of helps us out. Like I said, most of the activity is going to be done in the expansion area, and the tree, the haul route is going to head east on East Street, and it's going to go all the way to 58th Street, which we can't see from this view. 58th Street is a major collector, and their plan is to take a left on 58th, go by the Thurston High School, and then take a right on Main Street, with their terminus being on 42nd Street. Given that this could, potentially during whatever time of day they choose to do this, especially with the hauling, staff has asked that there'd be some additional conditions that might not otherwise be required in different pre-felling permit scenarios. So I'd like to go over those real quickly. Like I said, some of the trees are within the proposed development and right-of-way improvements. And I made a note that there'll have to be some coordination with the city and Willamette Lane, if any of it's on their property, to ensure that tree felling is done in the correct manner. The other is the haul route to Lane Forest. We put in a condition that not only allows for some coordination with the city and the neighbors and Thurston High School, to let us know at least 5 days ahead of time when the tree removal is going to occur, so that everyone's on the same page. Also, while contacting the school, I learned sort of the hours of operation when kids are actually going to school and leaving school. And so we put a restriction on the hauling and cutting hours, and I believe that restriction is 9 to 6, correct. And that, again, is to mitigate any sort of adverse impacts with people trying to get to school and, you know, otherwise, the neighboring environs. And then the last condition was to restrict the construction equipment off of the right-of-way and to have it retained on site, that way not causing any future congestion on the street or any concerns of that nature. Any questions about the tree felling? Okay, so I want to close.
Timing, is an issue, and 58th Street is an incredibly busy thoroughfare with school, and so I appreciate that staff have given some attention to that. There is a time frame when school releases,
right,
that is during that 9 to 6. Period, that could be problematic. So
Absolutely. Just
to be aware of that.
One of the things I didn't mention is with the correspondence with the city and the school and the contractor, they're going to have to identify their hours of operation. So whatever comes of the decision, if it's modified anymore, that'll have to be reflected, and that's the note that'll go out. And people on East Street will have that information and be able to sort of get an understanding when they're starting to hear something really loud across the street and wonder why. Any other questions on the tree film?
The only thing I would maybe, with it being 6 o'clock at night and it's getting dark now at 5,
right,
I don't know if that would be something that they'd want to look at too.
Absolutely. The tree felling operation probably wouldn't want to commence anywhere after 4. Yeah. So it probably could be a safe thing if the commission, believes that curtailing those hours could be another option. So I wanted to close out with the recommendation. Through separate deliberation and motion for each of the three applications being reviewed this evening, staff recommends the Planning Commission approve the applicant's proposal to expand the existing Sweetbriar Villa residential and memory care facility and add a child care facility within the new building addition. Any and all conditions for the recommended approval are contained within the staff report for each application. And for the benefit of the record, staff's recommendation for approval by the commission pertains to the following applications. The discretionary use request under case file TYP 315-00004, the site plan review application under case file TYP 215-00028, and the tree felling permit under case file TYP 215-00027. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you. We will now have testimony from the applicant.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commission. Thank you, Mr. McCaffrey, for a very very thorough explanation of the project. My name is Mark Miller. I'm with Hanker Moisen Architects. The address is 6720 Southwest McAdam Avenue, Portland, Oregon. So as mentioned, the plan for this project is, at present, it is a memory care facility and a residential care facility licensed in the state of Oregon. Approximately half of the site is currently vacant, and it has mature stands of fairly unregulated trees or unmaintained or just naturally occurring vegetation. The plan, the original property, has been sold to a new operator who, much like the original owner of the facility, is a family-run business who is very committed to the community and sees a need for additional residential care and memory care facilities in the Springfield area. So to that end, the plan is to build out the rest of the site as much as know, we feel is both responsible and as, you know, fits within the planning guidelines of the city. So as Mr. McCaffrey mentioned, the existing building will be converted entirely to memory care, and there will be a slight reduction in units to do that in order to create larger units that are a little more in keeping with the what's sort of happening in the industry right now and with state regulations. The new facility will be entirely a residential care facility with support spaces. You know, have sort of the dining areas, the lobby, library, activity spaces for the residents. It'll have internal courtyards, it'll be landscaped, that sort of thing. Again, there is an increase in the use on the facility, so there are going to be concerns about, you know, traffic impacts and that sort of thing. We understand that. Part of this project is actually going to be to do some street side improvements in conjunction with the city. When E Street gets intersects near 63rd, the street actually narrows quite a bit. Part of the proposal and what we've worked with the city to do is to widen E Street at that section, so it's more in keeping with the standards of the city presently. Because of that, we do, you know, it is going to pull back a bit. We will lose a little bit of those right-of-way trees, and that's actually the predominant reason those are being removed. Those three or four, I think, trees that are outside of our property line is entirely to create that right-of-way improvement. The rest of the trees will be removed, as Mr. McCaffrey said, because our development does occupy a sizable portion of that existing vacant property. We will be replanting about 80% of the trees, not quite in the same style, because there are a lot of Doug firs out there now, but we will at least continue the mature street trees that are along E Street now to create a more unified look to the rest of the building. And it will help with that residential feel. That's something else that's very important with this type of facility. It's not, you know, it's not really a medical kind of facility. It really is. It's senior housing. It's still housing. But, you know, it's not going to be allowed use or an incompatible use. And it's not going to generate in and of itself a lot of traffic with the residents themselves. The residents are not capable of driving themselves, so there won't be any increase from them. There will be an increase from visitors and the like. There will be, you know, slightly increased delivery schedules, most likely, since we are roughly doubling the size of the facility, of the units. So there will be a little increase in, you know, delivery schedules, but still within the current schedule that they basically hold now. It'll just probably occur more frequently at those same times during the week. And then there will be obviously traffic with visitors and a slightly increased staff. I think at present, the building has about 15 people staff on its current largest shift. It'll go up to about 25. So even though it's a doubling of the size of the property or the project, it's actually not doubling the number of staff. So there will be a little bit of economies of scale there. I do want to touch on a little bit on the daycare use, because I know that probably seems a little out of place or maybe incompatible, and it's actually a complementary use to senior housing that's especially becoming more and more prevalent now. It's called an intergenerational program, and it's really trying to introduce, just like it says, it, you know, different generations, trying to mix them, get them together. And there's really been some interesting studies lately where there's really a benefit to having senior residents and children interacting. It helps the seniors certainly with just kind of an outlook. It gives them, you know, some activities, some interest, and it gives a good kind of connection to the younger children. Just gives them a good connection to all aspects of their community and members of that community. In this particular case, I think actually it was mentioned that it would be for 13 or more. I think more likely it's really going to be 10 to 12 would be the more likely number of children there. And we're really talking kind of preschool age. Predominantly it would be open to the public, and it would also serve staff members at the facility, so they could drop off their children while they're actually working at the facility. At present, it hasn't been fully developed. There will be a specific provider contracted with to help fit out that space going forward. But again, I mean, that number is expected to be 10 to 12 children of preschool age. One thing I did want to touch on the condition of use, one of them was about increasing that size of the fence around their play structure from 4 feet to 6 feet and calling it a side obscuring fence. And I guess we, as you know, on the applicant's side, just wanted to discuss that and see if there would be any leeway on that. Just thinking more about, the nature of the children using it, they're going to be about 3 feet tall or something. And if you go to a 6 foot high fence that's, you know, pretty much opaque, and it's not, you know, an incredibly huge area that could be a little claustrophobic in some ways, it also prevents sort of that benefit of the residents who are ringing that play area from being able to kind of watch the children, and from the daycare itself from being able to see the children that might be out there. Additionally, where it is located is toward the rear of the property. The largest side of it that would be open or exposed is actually going to be across kind of that fire access road to Thurston High School, between it and the road there will be a fence there, as well as a landscape buffer. So there will be a little bit of a screening going on between, you know, the uses to begin with. And then to the east of the property, there is the park there too. So it's not necessarily, you know, a neighborhood, but it is a park with, you know, another play structure. So I think we just wanted to bring that up, that perhaps as a condition of approval, that may be something we would ask to revisit if there's some flexibility or leeway on that one, just from some practical standpoint. I'd like to mention that. So then the other sort of issue with, or the other, I guess, condition of approval that we would like to raise was that extra access for fire. So the specific location that was mentioned in the condition, it was, you know, provide a secondary access opposite 63rd Street for emergency services only. The access shall be gated and secured with a public works lock for manual gator and Oxbox for electronic aid. The issue with being able to do that is it's fairly technically infeasible in that the property actually sits above E Street. Some amount. We're doing a little bit of cutting and filling to try to level it out and mitigate with the street, but it actually sits at that point 7 feet above, 6 or 7 feet above E Street at the lowest, and it's only about, you know, 10 feet or so, less than 15, certainly about 10 feet to get from that. So that's a significant amount of grade change to try to overcome in order to get that extra access. So we have been talking with the fire marshal today a little bit about, you know, providing a different way or alternate ways to provide that same level of service. As we understand it, the issue is getting enough hose length to the hydrant, which was being proposed on E Street itself. What they are preliminarily agreeable to is if we were to actually provide no access as we originally showed it, and then we would do some private fire hydrants in the northeast corner and the south, kind of just below the new project itself. That would provide them enough hose reach that it would probably be acceptable to them. So we're perfectly willing and fine with doing some sort of increased fire access. We just want to make sure that would, you know, that we raise the fact that way the condition is written right now, we would pretty much be beholden to providing it as a physical curb cut access, which is technically infeasible at this point. So we would like to provide alternate means that's agreeable to the fire marshal to still provide that same level of service, but not that specific way. And then one sort of last item wanted to mention on the tree felling permit. I know there has obviously been some discussion about the time involved where that would occur. The and actually, I want to say that they're all very, very valid concerns. In terms of the lateness of the time that it would be involved, right now we're probably projecting that construction wouldn't start until March or so. So certainly it will be getting a little lighter. We'll have daylight savings at that point as well. So it will be a little lighter, a little later. Whether or not that really factors into, you know, if you want to curtail the hours, still certainly within your purview to do that. I just want to mention that this will be occurring a little later in the year than right now. But again, it does make sense if there, especially if there is concern about school traffic, definitely, you know, we'll work with that. That's a real concern for us as well. So, that is what I have for that.
Now I have public testimony. I have no cards, so is there anyone who wishes to speak in favor of this proposal? Is there anyone who wishes to speak opposed to this proposal? And could you state your name and address for the record?
Yes. Good evening, commissioners, and thank you for the opportunity to speak this evening. My name is Joanne Hugie. Last name is H-U-G-I. My mailing address is P.O. Box 10, Walterville, Oregon. I'm happy to have the opportunity to address my concerns about the Sweetbriar Villa proposal. I own a home on 62nd Street, which is really just down the street from the proposed development. I have no problem with the proposed use of this facility, since I may well need such a facility in the future myself. However, I am opposed to permitting a two-story building in this primarily residential neighborhood of single-family homes, adding a footprint of 28,900 square feet with a total of 49,500 square feet in a two-story building is just plain out of scale with this neighborhood. I am especially dismayed with this two-story proposal. I would hope that Springfield will not make a Eugene-like decision and ghetto-wise lovely little neighborhood. The approval of this zoning change in a low-density residential neighborhood would set a negative precedent for future zoning requests. Any small neighborhood would be at risk of being adversely changed for the worse. If this facility were limited to a single story, I would have fewer objections to the expansion plans. Thank you very much for listening to my concerns.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to speak in opposition to this application?
I need this building.
Okay, right here.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify who is neutral? And now we'll have the staff summary. Do you have any closing remarks? Is there any summary or rebuttal from the applicant?
To address, I guess, the concerns of the two-story, it is, you know, certainly it's a different scale for that area. We have attempted, it's not going to be, you know, the same as a single-family home, but what we have tried to do within the design of the building is we've broken up the roof line a bit, so there are some massing changes. It's at least not a, you know, a large-scale two-story. It's not just a, you know, kind of a layer cake of storiness. I mean, there's some ins and outs, there's some pulls to it. There is a little bit of, well, actually, it's, I guess you can sort of see with the, in the blue area on the plan that we have here, there's some pull back away from what would be the street on the top there from the East Street. We do have, you know, a lot of landscaping, so there will be a softening of that edge as well. I guess we, you know, we certainly can't, I guess, hide the fact that it's a two-story building, but I feel that, you know, we have worked to provide a little different massing to it and to bring down the scale of it so that it doesn't feel like a two-story building slamming into a one-story. There is a, even the middle part is more of, you know, sort of a half to help step that up. So, it doesn't necessarily fully address the fact that it is a two-story, but there has been some effort and attention put to trying to help that scale be more in keeping with the neighborhood.
So when you do, if it goes through, is the existing building going to be completely redone in terms of the outside facade, or is it going to remain what it is?
Okay, good question. So the existing building, all we're really proposing to do to the exterior, we will add a very small part in the back to just increase three of the units' sizes. But in general, all we're going to do is we're going to probably update the paint to match what we're doing with the new. So we are planning to keep intact the existing building.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As a consideration of request for continuation of the public hearing, extension of the written record, or both. We will close or continue the public hearing, close or extend the written record. Continuance or extension by motion.
Okay, I will move for closure of the public record on all three actions before the commission.
Second. All right, motion made by Commissioner James, second by Commissioner Gunn to close the public hearing and the written record on all three applications.
All in favor?
Thank you. Yes, there would be a vote, voice vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. So then I'll close the public hearing. Planning Commission discussion, questions for staff or for the applicant, or discussion?
Question for Mark. It's been a time, yes, it's been a time since I've been through that neighborhood. Are there any two-story homes in that area?
Yeah, I can maybe just step back a second. For low-density residential, the maximum building height is 30 feet. And that's basically from grade, and if you have a gable or hipped roof, that could be to the middle of that roof. So just to give an idea of how something can look 30 feet in a residential neighborhood. In that area, there are several duplexes that are two-story, from what I've seen. There are a lot of single-story ranches in the neighborhood, especially as we head towards 58th Street. But going up 63rd, I noticed there were some two stories. Whether the story was being used as a second story or not, and so I guess one of the challenges is this property itself is a little bit elevated. So for thinking south, you start to go up a slight little embankment, so it does have a bit of a prominence in the area. But with respect to grade, the building elevations that were submitted by the applicant were 30 feet for the two stories.
Is there
can you speak into the mic?
Yeah.
Thanks.
The applicant talked about the concern with, because I did drive by the property today, and that it is elevated, and that secondary access for the fire safety, is that, I don't know, what do you guys consider with that issue?
As far as adding another one?
Yeah.
Well, the idea was sort of based on where the applicant had placed a fire hydrant. And upon looking at it, the fire marshal saw some concerns with being able to use that fire hydrant to actually suppress or support any issues that may be going on in the eastern new addition, which prompted him to want some sort of secondary access, albeit gated. And that's why I had mentioned that there could be some changes, not only to the landscaping plans that we've seen here tonight, but also it's sort of in a good point where this can get sort of ironed out, so to speak, because there is a public improvement plan which has input from our transportation planning engineer. And so I see it, if we work in concert to figure out what the best access, if any, from E Street, it all be additional completely or just for emergency accesses. It doesn't seem like it would ruin what's being placed on the property as we can see right now. So from a condition level, right now we have language in there that speaks to placing that access closer to 63 and 63rd and E Street. So if that wasn't something the commission would want to have seen met, if there's more coordination that needs to occur between all interested parties, perhaps that condition could be modified in a way that speaks to that.
Such as, or alternate fire access that is amenable to the fire marshal and the city.
Right, something to that nature.
Right.
Yeah.
The concern about the playground fencing, I want to understand that situation a little bit better. We have, they've submitted in their proposed plan a 4-foot fence around the play structure, is that correct?
Right.
And that is not to code, that is what?
Correct, yeah.
Tell me where we're at with that.
Sure, so specifically in the specific development standards that I brought up that pertain to child care centers, I guess that's the key word here because we identified this use as a child care center, which is 13 or more children in a specific facility, a licensed facility. There's a difference when we think of child care homes where we don't see that specific development standard because it's ultimately happening in a residence. This is not happening in a residence. It's happening in a residential care facility or a use that's been discretionarily approved. And it specifically says in a provision that a 6-foot site obscuring fence be used to sort of circumference any sort of outdoor play area. In other situations, we can see how that could be extremely valuable, especially if you're neighboring a big subdivision or at least in proximity to 2 or 3 backyards. In this case, it falls a little flat in the sense that there's Thurston ballparks right behind it. So it is a little bit different, but if we're looking at the code, that's what it requires.
Well, I'll just, my feeling here is site-specific. That is on the back side. That's on the south side of that complex. Mm-hmm. It's on the complete opposite side of the complex than the residential area, facing the fire lane for Thurston High School. Mm-hmm. And if what I heard was part of the reasoning for having child care in this facility is this concept of wellness for the folks that are living there, as well as child care for the folks that are working there and others that might want to bring their kids there. And it seems to me that a side obscuring 6-foot fence really does not meet the objective, even though it may meet the requirements of the code. In this particular instance, I don't know that it is necessary in this particular case. That's just my personal feeling. If they're trying to have the residents be able to see kids at play, which is a great thing. They certainly aren't going to be able to do that with a 6-foot side obscuring fence. So, and I understand the city, you have codes for a reason. You know, I've been on the Planning Commission for a while, and I get that. But I also get there are some times when those codes don't necessarily make the absolute best sense. So, you know, I would hope that the city would work with the applicant in that particular case to help mitigate that somewhat so that they can meet their objectives. Just my feeling.
I appreciate your thoughts, Commissioner. One idea that I was thinking about, trying to think about the functionality of this facility once it gets up and going, there will be traffic traveling on that back lane, so to speak, because that is a connector not only from where people might be parking on the western side, but they're not going to turn around and keep going west. They're going to, it's going to be a very lightly traveled but pretty consistent thoroughway. So you can see maybe there is some concerns about having some sort of
safety barrier
between the outdoor play area and the people that are driving not too far away. That being said, I might defer to our current development manager, Mr. Mott, here about getting relief for quantifiable standards, which this would sound like it would need, given that there is a specific height that's been defined as part of the provision, the 6-foot height.
Well, you know, I mean, you drive in the Willamette Lane Center, and they have a child care facility there. And I know it's different because it's zoned differently, but those kids, the fence is high there, but it's not side obscured. You can see the kids at play.
Right.
And so there probably is a way to still provide a sight line for those residents to see the children, but have some level of safety.
Mark, are the criteria that the fence is a certain height and sight obscuring, or is it just that it's a certain height?
Correct. I'm going to verify because I believe we have it open at the moment.
Yeah.
I'll pull it up here in a second.
Okay.
You haven't memorized that?
That's when I get in trouble. Okay. So child care centers, all right, this is just for record, it's SDC 4.7-125, child care facilities. Section B sub 2, the outdoor play area shall be enclosed by a 6-foot high sight obscuring fence. In residential districts, the director may require up to a 10-foot wide landscape buffer from an outdoor play area if it conflicts with neighboring properties or if conflicts with neighboring properties are identified. So the most interesting part of that sentence is the first part, and the language is 6-foot high sight obscuring fence.
So there might be, so we're in a tricky spot here because this is a quasi-judicial one based on criteria, and we all, you know, you need to base any conditions of approval and the decision on the criteria. I'm wondering though if we can still have the condition about a 6-foot high side obscuring fence, and when the applicant is actually constructing the fence, there might be a way to construct that with some material or some kind of way that's not, when I think of side obscuring, I'm either thinking of like the slats and a chain link fence or a full-on wooden fence, and they might be able to do something that still meets the height requirement, is somewhat side obscuring, but is not a full-on block from the road.
Or it could be side obscuring from the roadway to the rear and be open to the internal, so
right.
It can still
so
be visible
people can
on
still
the inside.
See, because it's really not the people driving down the road that
exactly.
You're so, but you're thinking residents of the facility
exactly.
Might be nice for them to have some interaction
exactly.
There and see.
Exactly right.
Does that seem in the ballpark of something that we can do?
Yeah, that's a reasonable.
Okay. Okay, great. So then I think for the purposes of the decision, there wouldn't be it wouldn't be necessary thing to change a condition of approval or anything. I think we're probably okay. We're just clear that
okay.
It might be nice on the inside there to have some vision there for the facility, and then on the outside to think about doing that in a way that's not completely side obscuring, but still keep the 6 feet. So I think that's all right.
My question would be, since there's an elevation change, would elevation enter into this discussion at any point? As to what point on the elevation that the fence is actually going to be constructed?
As far as it's...
Well, in other words, it's been spoken that there's an elevation change that enters into this as far as where exactly the fence is going to be built. So whether it's on the high point of the elevation or the low point, whether that would enter into the into a factor of what the ultimate height will be.
I don't believe so, Commissioner. The way that the site works right now, and I may defer to the applicant for some more information, but it's relatively flat. The mention I made earlier was when you're standing on E Street, there is a bit of a rise to get you onto what I would consider the bench of the developable property. And so once you're up there, you're measuring grade, you know, of what will be most likely some sort of semi-permanent or paved surface for that fence to go on. And so we'll probably have a pretty good, accurate, congruent fence all the way around if it is in fact 6 feet, because it's gonna be on flat ground that's measurable.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Anyone on the commission?
Commissioners, I just wanted to make sure before you close your deliberations that we're all on the same page about the flyer access. I know there was some discussion about that. Did the applicant, were you okay with the condition of approval with the flyer access, the discussion there?
With the discussion, we're just sort of going to say or other.
So how it's worded is okay?
How it was proposed, the way it's worded, required to do the actual access from 63rd.
So we could add some language about or as amenable to the city and the
Yes, county. Yes. Okay.
Yep. So this is number 13.
Okay.
And this is the site plan review.
Perfect.
That's what's got to change.
Did the commission have any other discussion or any other issues that they want to talk about?
Just one other comment. I appreciate the testimony. I am getting older, and we care for in our home a disabled mother, and I know that there's an increasing need in our society for these types of care facilities. I believe that site will be with what the developer has suggested. It will fit well into that environment. I think with the improvements to the roadway that are proposed, the traffic to those types of facilities. Are more visitor traffic, because the residents aren't coming and going. So, I think it's good that we are providing a quality care facility opportunity for our community. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could. A couple of things just for purposes of clarification and the record. You heard testimony tonight that alluded to a zone change for the property in order to allow this to go forward. And I'm not sure if the person testifying was using that as a specific term of the law or just sort of a term of art. But there is no request to change the zoning on this property. This use is permitted through discretionary approval with the current Wodinski residential zoning. As Mr. McCaffrey pointed out, the building height limits in the low-density residential are being applied to this structure, so it's not exceeding the height limit that would be permitted in low-density residential if this were a single-family home. Absolutely, there's no question in terms of scale, it's different than other things that are there, and will be, certainly unless an apartment building was to go in, which would require a zone change. I wouldn't expect that anybody would build a 49,500 square foot single family home. That's just not in the cards. So one of the considerations that you have under discretionary review criteria is a subjective evaluation of any identified negative effects of the proposal that you would have some ability to influence or to mitigate. That's not a specific item that's identified. And I know in the past in other hearings you've heard people talk about two-story structures next door to single-story structures and the sort of the trespass, that at least the psychological effect of that by, you know, viewing what's going on in someone's backyards, an unfortunate consequence of urban living, but that's what happens. So it's certainly easy to understand her point of view, but it's not so easy to create a circumstance that would enable you to purposefully change that structure so that it was more consistent with that character and nature of the neighborhood, because that's not a criteria. The second thing is the suggestion by Mr. McCaffrey that I knew more about defense standards than he did, and I don't. But I did find something that's kind of interesting, and it's in the fencing and screening standards in Chapter 4, and it's in 4.4.115 sub-C 5. Sub-C is where discretionary use approval is required for fences. The following criteria of approval apply in lieu of criteria specified. Now, there is no DU required to actually have a fence, but you're in a DU context, so, and then fence is the issue. And it says the Planning Commission, based on the evidence presented, shall approve, modify, or deny the request. The Planning Commission may further condition the request, including but not limited to imposition of following conditions: establishing the extent of the site eligible for the fencing, establishing minimum and maximum height requirements, setbacks from all property lines, and requiring specific fencing material. That, you know, I think the purpose of this section is to enable somebody who is feeling a lack of security or wants additional security to request that the Planning Commission extend that right to construct a fence, either where there's some limitation on the fence or there's some limitation on either the minimum or maximum height of the fence. But it's interesting that the facility for the Planning Commission is to consider both the minimum and maximum height of a fence that's serving some security purposes, which clearly this is doing. So I don't think that this section was constructed to be relief from the section that Mark cited for the 6 foot minimum side of screen fence. It, you know, within the context of the discretionary use process, if particular attributes are being identified either as something that's having a negative impact on the proposal, and you heard testimony regarding the height of the size of a two-story building as being that, but I can't find any mechanism for you to address that that would probably satisfy the person providing the testimony. This other aspect is a particular feature that the applicant has described as creating a circumstance that they find to be not specifically unacceptable, but sort of a contradiction in the purpose of having a secured play area, but then not actually being able to see into the play area. I suppose unless there's somebody in attendance the whole time, and I'm not sure if childcare, the laws and the childcare requirements specify that. You don't happen to know that, do you?
I don't.
Okay. So I suppose you can consider that to be relevant, and if you want to make a decision on that, cite this section. Again, I don't recall ever using it, so I can't say specifically that the application of it in this case is consistent with the intent of the code was when it was drafted. But certainly there are elements of this item that was raised before you under both the context of you addressing a discretionary use request and in specifically the minimum maximum height of a required fence. So it's about as...
There's mine, Greg.
That's a terrible question.
So, so what you're saying is that 4.415.C.5 describes the Planning Commission's ability to take into consideration mitigating factors should they choose to. I think where we landed on this was that within the conditions described, the city would work with the applicant and see if we could, within the framework of what's been presented, mitigate that. I mean, and I'm fine with that.
Okay.
So I would rather do that because the city's really good at working with our developers in taking those things into consideration. You've heard from the commission a concern. You've heard from the applicant a desire to have that interaction. I think as you move forward, you'll take that into consideration and deal within the, you know, what's doable within the code to see if you can't mitigate that. And I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Any further discussion then?
I'll just add that if we've come up with a condition for the a proposed condition for condition number 11 on the site plan review, which addresses the secondary access. So that's on page 17 of 19 on attachment 3, number 11. And the condition could be changed to say prior to final site plan approval. That is, I'm sorry, provide a secondary access opposite 63rd Street for emergency services only that is amenable to the city and the applicant as related to the fire safety for the site. And then that will back off some of that specificity about the gate and the switch and the electric grate. I think what we're all understanding here is we want the site to be secure so it just doesn't become like a pass-through. And the applicant's in agreement with that change, the city's in agreement with that change, and I think that gets to the intent of the condition. So just for your consideration as you work through your deliberation, and that would be for the site plan review.
All right, anything else before we entertain a motion? All right, motion to approve with conditions, or deny the application based on the information contained in the staff report, oral and written testimony, and all other evidence submitted into the record. And we will do each of these case files individually. So we'll begin with TYP 315-0004.
I move to approve TYP 315-0004 Sweetbriar Villa Residential Care Facility Discretionary Use Permit for the expansion of the residential care facility, including a child care facility, map and tax lot number 17-02-34-24-03901, because the application meets the standards of the criteria in the Springfield Development Code.
Do we want to include your condition?
That's in.
Then we have a second.
I will second.
Okay. Motion made by Vice Chair Nelson, second by Commissioner James. And we will vote by voice vote only. Those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries for TYP 315-0004. So then we will move on to entertaining a motion for TYP 215-00027.
I'll move to approve TYP 215-0027 Sweetbriar Villa Tree Failing Permit Map and Tax Lot number 17-02-34-24-03901, because the application meets the standards of the criteria in the Springfield Development Code.
And a second?
Second.
All right, motion made by Vice Chair Nelson, second by Commissioner James, and we will vote by votes vote only. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. And finally, we will do entertaining motion on TYP 215-00028.
I would move to approve TYP 215-00028 Sweetbriar Villa site plan approval, map and tax lot number 17-02-34-24-03901, because the application meets the standards of the criteria in the Springfield Development Code, with the addition of site access condition as described by the city legal counsel.
Here a second.
Second.
A motion made by Commissioner James, second by Commissioner Dunn. We will vote on voice vote only. Those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. So then we can move on to other parts of the agenda. We have any business from the Planning Commission?
Do we need to close the hearing?
Pardon?
Do we need to close the hearing still?
I did earlier.
She closed it. We're good. Yep, the hearing and the record are closed.
Okay. Business from the Public Works Director and or Council Action?
No business. I didn't attend the council meeting.
Do we have any reports from the commissioners on council action?
At this time.
And we will adjourn.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Since we have nothing scheduled in December, is that correct?
That's correct.
And there was no continuance. It's a question about nominating and voting for new chair and vice chair for the upcoming year. As the traditional action to take in your final meeting of the calendar year.
Generally, it goes to those people that aren't here.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that we had no more scheduled activities
for the
end of the year.
Yeah.
Well, then, in that case, we will have an unscheduled agenda item then to cover
so
that.
So, we're unadjourned.
Yeah, we are unadjourned until we can.
Commissioners, I have served in the past as the chair. Nick has certainly served as the vice chair for 2 years now. I certainly am willing to move back through the vice chair and chair position. I have, I think, 3 years remaining on my second term with the commission. So I just put that on the table. However, you will see fit to take action on that. I would be willing to serve in whatever capacity you would be willing to have.
I will state myself that it is my desire not to be the chair in 2016. Now, the other thing that, in regard to what your comments were, that I became chair without going through the first step of being vice chair. So I don't feel, unless there's contradictory evidence otherwise, that it would be necessary for you to go through each step if you had the desire to be the chair, and depending on, of course, what other people's thoughts are on the subject.
Well, I certainly want to give Nick an opportunity, should he choose, but he, in the past, has not shown a desire to do that, but however that may be different.
I mean, I would step up. I think I'd want to do some training with Brenda, but I think I could do it.
That's pretty much automatic with the position deal and orientation.
So I wouldn't, I'd take on being chair.
Well, I would certainly support that. So I would nominate Nick Nelson for chair of the Planning Commission for the forthcoming year.
I will second that recommendation. We probably wouldn't need to vote on that. We have it in favor?
Yeah.
Okay, we have. Then Vice Chair Nelson will become the chair for calendar year 2016, and then and Vice Chair. Would you have any discussion, further discussion on Commissioner James' offer?
These two are both new with me, relatively, so unless Steve really had a desire to, and I don't know if he does.
Well, of course.
Steve is on for another 8 months or so.
He's
been chair multiple times in the past. So.
Plus the fact that his term ends in mid-year, right. So he would probably not.
So.
Of course, the other consideration is that since we did have an agenda item that wasn't on the agenda, whether our two absentees would have had any interest in this, and I guess they're out simply by their absence of being considered. So I guess then that you place your name in the consideration for vice chair.
I certainly would.
Okay.
I'd nominate Greg to be vice chair.
All right. And so, all right, and we have a unanimous consideration of Vice Chair Nelson as chair and Commissioner James as vice chair for the upcoming year.
Thank you very much.
So now we can adjourn.
Can't wait to get that gavel.
As long as you don't throw it this way.
I don't
have orientation for running around all the stuff.